From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Poet Anne Sexton became popular in the late 1950s after turning to poetry at the suggestion of her therapist, but she continued to suffer from mental illness and eventually killed herself. Sexton's biography became controversial because the author Diane Middlebrook drew from recordings of Sexton's psychiatric sessions. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from Diane Middlebrook and we'll feature an interview with Anne Sexton's daughter, who wrote a memoir about her mother, which has just come out in paperback. Also, we hear from performance poet Maggie Estep, who's featured on the PBS series The United States of Poetry, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new NBC miniseries, Gulliver's Travels. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. While people in the Midwest and Plain States shiver in record cold temperatures, snow and ice are causing traffic problems and closing down schools and businesses from the South through New England today. From Dallas, NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The winter storm that has caused record lows across the plains and in the Northeast brought a sheet of ice and freezing rain to parts of Arkansas, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana. The icy roads caused major traffic problems all across the region, including a 12-car pileup in South Texas. Shelters for the homeless are overflowing, and officials in New Orleans say they'll open more. The winter storm is heading east into Virginia and the Carolinas. Several inches of ice and snow are expected in the mid-Atlantic states by tomorrow. Parts of Dallas got up to 2 inches of a mixture of sleet and snow overnight. The National Weather Service says the Arctic front that is moving across Texas will keep this unusual blast of cold air around through the weekend, with a chance for more snow in Texas on Saturday. I'm Kathy Lohr in Dallas.
Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says legislation passed by Congress to ensure that Social Security beneficiaries get their checks next month will have the effect of delaying the threatened government default on debt until mid-March. The bill frees $30 billion the government can use to pay its upcoming bills. The legislation includes a pledge by Congress to increase the federal borrowing limit by March 1st. The nation's unemployment rate rose 0.2% last month. It was the first increase in 3 months. There were 210,000 fewer jobs in January. UPI's Bill Small says the White House is blaming the rise in the jobless rate on the blizzard that hit the eastern states last month.
The chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, Joseph Stiglitz, says the increased unemployment rate last month should be interpreted with caution. The jobless rate increased 0.2% in January, ending up at 5.8%, the highest it's been since April of last year. Stiglitz, however, says the decline in employment was due mainly to the blizzard that hit the eastern United States during the reference week for the government's jobless report. He also says there may have been some lingering impact from the government shutdown caused by the budget impasse. Stiglitz says the administration fully expects employment growth to resume. Bill Small at the White House.
A dump truck slammed into a school bus near Gainesville, Florida today, injuring 24 children and 2 adults. The roadway was foggy at the time. The Florida Highway Patrol says none of the injuries were serious. A charter bus carrying students from the University of Florida in Gainesville flipped over in West Virginia today, injuring at least 44 people on board. The bus was rounding a curve on a snow-covered mountain road when the driver lost control. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 33.5 points at 5,371 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The owner of the Seattle Seahawks of the National Football League has decided to move the team out of the city. The team will reportedly play its games at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California next season. King County, Washington, which owns the 20-year-old King Dome where the team plays, has filed suit in state court seeking to block the move. The team owner has filed a countersuit. The U.S. says it will contribute $2 million to help alleviate the famine in North Korea, despite reservations by South Korea. The announcement comes after a Red Cross official, Dr. Piero Calvo Parasetti, said aid workers in North Korea believe the situation there is worsening. The BBC's Sophie Fisher reports from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Dr. Calvo Parasetti said that food shortages in North Korea are severe and getting worse. The Red Cross is concentrating its efforts on about 100,000 people who are seen as the most vulnerable because they lost everything in the floods. However, Dr. Calvi Parasetti says the entire population is now at risk because they aren't getting enough to eat. The current average food ration per person is 9 kilograms a month. That's only about 70% of what's necessary. In India, for example, the average food intake is 12 kilos a month, although even that isn't really enough. The North Korean government has stocks of grain, but Dr. Calvi Parasetti said Pyongyang was right to ration the release of these supplies. Red Cross officials say that after last August's floods, much of the farmland is now covered in sand or rocks and looks like the Sahara Desert.
The BBC's Sophie Fisher. In the second day of a strike by more than a million coal miners in Russia and Ukraine, the Russian government appears to be ready to make an agreement to get the workers back on the job. The miners are demanding hundreds of millions of dollars in back wages. One strike leader says a government official in Moscow has agreed with the miners' demands. Political analysts say Russian President Boris Yeltsin is eager to settle the strike because he faces an election this spring. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the more controversial literary biographies of the past few years examined the life of the late poet Anne Sexton. The biographer, Diane Middlebrook, took on the project at the request of Sexton's daughter, Linda. After the publication of the Sexton biography, Sexton's daughter wrote her own book, a memoir about growing up with a mother who was a gifted poet but was mentally ill. That memoir has just come out in paperback. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear first from Sexton's biographer, Diane Middlebrook, and then from Sexton's daughter, Linda Gray Sexton. The biography was controversial because it used as source material tape recordings of therapy sessions Sexton had with her psychiatrist. There are many thorny issues Diane Middlebrook had to deal with. Anne Sexton was tortured by a mental disorder and started writing poetry as a suicidal housewife undergoing psychiatric treatment. Some of her poetry was about being institutionalized, some about her self-destructive impulses. Sexton succeeded in taking her life in 1974 at the age of 45. Some people think the romance of self-destruction won her a larger following than her poems deserved. Others say she was never taken as seriously as she should have been by the male literary establishment because she wrote poems about subjects like women's sexuality and menstruation. When Sexton's daughter asked Middlebrook to write the biography, Middlebrook was surprised by the invitation, but she agreed to do it.
I did, though, have a certain question about whether I was the right person because I was not a big fan of Anne Sexton's poetry. I had my preferences. I thought there were gems, but I didn't, I wasn't just a passionate fan of her work. And I told Linda Sexton that right away. She said to me, well, I'm not much of a fan of academic writing either, but I know we need a scholar to do this book. So why don't you write a prospectus and let's go from there? So it was a decision taken on both sides with the sense that there was a goal to be met, which was a book that had a reliable research behind it and that was going to be based on extremely extensive records of a most private and confidential kind. From the outset, Linda Sexton had decided, that no biographer I think has had the luck I had in this regard, that every document that Anne Sexton left behind was going to be open to the biographer for at least deep background reading. Whether I could use it or not would be a decision made later, and I agreed with Linda at the outset in a businesslike way that at the end of the process of writing it, I would show her the book, and of course it was hers to withdraw permission or withhold permission to quote unpublished material, which included, of course, any of the comments that she made on her therapy tapes or in her therapy notebooks, but that basically I could use my own, it was my book.
Now, the tapes is a whole different subject, and I want to get to that in a couple of minutes. First, I want to know this. Since you weren't Anne Sexton's biggest fan, what made you think that she was really important enough to devote a biography to and to devote your time to?
She had an extremely important career. I knew that at the outset. That is, I knew the Sexton myth that I knew was a woman who rose out of a mental breakdown to become a poet almost overnight, became a very popular poet. About 500,000 books have been sold. That's a lot for a poet. And who had a very big audience and a very successful business career in poetry at a time in American poetry when the women's movement was just getting generated, really, out of circumstances like Sexton's. The housewife who has the breakdown, who finds herself and becomes a professional, who has a very sort of exhibitionistic sexuality, who performs very, very well, and who kills herself. All of those were sort of part of the pre-1975 women's movement material. That interested me a lot. I also knew that I had a lot of biases that were built into my own education, which was not heavy on women's literature, I must say, and also that there was in me a kind of a creepy fear of people like Anne Sexton, people I just kind of wanted to keep out of my consciousness, and all of those seemed like good reasons to be interested in her.
I'd like you to read a poem by Anne Sexton that you think is an example of her writing at her best.
Sexton was a master of technique, and she remained that throughout her life. When she learned to write, she went to school, basically, to very formalist writers. It was a skill that she never lost. She didn't use it very much in her later work. However, there's a series of poems in her book, her most popular book, Love Poems, that I think is just lovely and very gripping. And to people who don't know Anne Sexton's work very well, it seems to me this one will give a feeling of both of the mastery of technique and the utter intimacy of her voice. This is one of the sequence, 18 Days Without You, and this is December 11th. Then I think of you in bed, your tongue half chocolate, half ocean, of the houses that you swing into, of the steel wool hair on your head, of your persistent hands, and then how we gnaw at the barrier because we are two. How you come and take my blood cup and link me together and take my brine. We are bare. We are stripped to the bone, and we swim in tandem and go up and up the river, the identical river called mine, and we enter together. No one's alone. Now, that poem, as I think you could probably hear, is very tightly rhymed. Cup and up. Brine rhymes in a way with bone and alone. It also rhymes with mine. There are all these beautiful little interior chimes in the poem, and yet it has, I think, the expressive urgency of something that's occurring as the lines fall. It's an emotion, a curve of affect being traced by the poem. That is Sexton at her best. She is an intimate writer, and the sense of a deep feeling, the reality of feeling, is very present in her work when she is writing, I think, at top speed.
Mm-hmm. Hey, listen, if you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Middlebrook, who's written a biography of the poet Anne Sexton. Now, in your introduction to the biography, you said that there were several questions you were particularly interested in trying to answer. How did a mad housewife become a star? What connected her madness and her art? And I want to ask you, what are some of the special problems when you're a biographer of writing about an artist who was mad?
I think the illness tends to take such prominence, first of all, because an illness like Sexton's is very repetitious. You know, it happened, so it has to be said, but it gets boring as reading it. It suddenly becomes the thing you're fearing as a reader, so bracing yourself again, is she going to commit suicide again? And I knew that was a writing problem in a way. The illness is the ground from which the arc of achievement has to be launched. So trying to subdue the madness, trying to account for it, to get it compartmentalized or, let's say, understood, focused on, and then passed beyond became for me the goal because I did not want to write a victim story in this book. Equally, I was concerned about ending the book with suicide because the rules of narrative say that the way a book ends tells you what it's been about. And so I didn't want it to be read as a book that is leading inexorably to self-destruction. And I didn't see how I could solve that problem, actually, for a long time. I wrote her suicide in the middle of the book as one of the, you know, it's like I sort of stepped back and said, okay, here's another suicide attempt. Now, eventually, she killed herself, but it was part of her repetitious illness, da-da-da. Turned out that was far too abstract and academic a way to treat it. I needed to put it at the end of the book, but I didn't want it to... I didn't understand it well enough when I was still afraid of it to not to understand that Anne Sexton had, in fact, killed herself in a very dignified and, in my view, timely way. When the material finally unfolded and showed itself to me in its full, I think, ceremonial beauty, I felt much better about permitting the book to end where it had to end.
Now, your biography of Anne Sexton has become very controversial because you used tapes from her psychiatric sessions, tapes that her psychiatrist had kept, and Anne Sexton's daughter, who is responsible for the literary estate, decided to let you have those tapes. Now, some people think you really should not have used them, but you did, and we'll get to why in a minute. But you know, you say that after hearing the tapes, you started the book over from scratch. What did you hear that made you think you had to redefine your whole approach to writing this biography?
I think that I had treated Sexton in my first manuscript as a kind of a historical figure who was kept at a distance in a way. I thought that there were a lot of interesting things about her. I'd written a chapter called Suicide. I'd written a chapter called Therapies. I'd written a chapter, actually, on the school that Anne Sexton went to, which was poetry workshops. It seemed to me she was a product of a very interesting American sort of education. So I took a sort of historical interest in her. And also, I found later, I think I had a lot of defenses against Anne Sexton. I didn't want to get too close to her. So the manuscript I wrote, I think it was really pretty good, but it was also very abstract. It was also more like a series of lectures than it was a narrative. When I came close to her, as I did, by having her pass through my head in earphones for a couple of years, she became a real person to me. And I also, I don't know, I found myself very attached to her. I was curious about things that she said and felt. I was very amused by her. She's very funny. She had a great voice. She was a wonderful actress. Even in these tapes, you can feel the range of character she was able to project. And she also was much sicker than I ever realized she was. So I had an intimate kind of relationship to her at the end of that process that made me feel that I needed to write a story about her, actually. And I think all the thinking I had done in advance served me very well. It sort of got submerged in the narrative, but what took over was the story of a life. And I think the book is much better for that.
My guest is Diane Middlebrook, the biographer of poet Anne Sexton. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anne Sexton's biographer, Diane Middlebrook. Sessions between doctor and therapist are always confidential, and a lot of people feel that these tapes should not have been source material for your biography, that they should have remained confidential between the patient and the doctor. And even the chair of the Ethics Committee of the American Psychiatric Association said, "Our viewpoint is that only the patient can give the release. What the family wants doesn't matter." And he made it clear that he thought that the confidentiality between patient and therapist should extend beyond the life of the patient. Tell me why you decided that, in spite of that confidential relationship, that these tapes should be source material.
Well, I'm a biographer, not a psychiatrist. And first of all, the question of the release of material to the family is not a hard and fast rule in psychiatry. After all, I was through the estate, I was able to have access to psychiatric hospital records, which are full of clinical notes. And those are routinely released. Sometimes it takes a court order, other times just a family request. But there is that psychiatric records are passed from hospitals anyway to families. The question of the doctor-patient dyad and its the ability to, let's say, invade it as I've done, it really does rest on the patient's willingness, on some views take another one, but in any case, the internal debate about the ethics of confidentiality within the psychiatry profession is itself, I think, more ambiguous and complicated than that statement from a very authoritative source would suggest. But a biographer looks at a person, I think, as, in a funny way, a sort of a generator of documents and memories that the biographer has a special privilege toward. I wouldn't dream of reading, or I would dream of it, but I wouldn't do it, reading my husband's mail, for example, when he's alive. Those things are his stuff. But once you die, you're beyond harm. And if you're a person in whom society takes an interest, those things you leave behind become really cultural property, I think is the word I'd want to use. And Sexton did have, I think, an attitude, as one of her friends said to me, psychotherapy was not an intimate subject to her. She was in it all the time. She took it very casually. She leaked it to friends. She played her tapes to people. She transcribed them and sent them to people. So she herself didn't feel the confidentiality issue was not a big deal to her. Now, she did not sign a statement about that, so that's why it's disputed.
How do you weigh wanting to make a dead artist's life public so we can better understand her and what she represents in our culture with wanting to protect the living, the family who survives, who still should have a right to privacy?
Well, of course, that is the central, I think, moral issue for somebody working in private papers. And my own guidelines were to try to avoid, as far as possible, exposing people to invasion. I was as selective as I could be in showing exemplary things about Sexton's life. And for example, at the end of the process of writing the book, I had worked very closely with Anne Sexton's living sister, who had given me a marvelous interview from which I drew heavily. She was a great storyteller, very generous. But as we got closer to the end, she had seen a couple of the versions of manuscripts of the biography. And at the end, she said, "I want you to take my interview out, because I see that this is a book about Anne Sexton, and I don't want to be a party to the lies she told about my family." I said to her, "You know, growing up in a family, I find that I have a different parents from my sisters, you know, like different things happen to us in family life. So the fact that you didn't have the relationships that Anne Sexton had to these people doesn't mean that she didn't have them. And it's, you know, clear that for her, these were very problematic relationships." Well, Blanche Taylor said to me, I think she said something that I thought was a very honorable position. She said, "I know, but my voice will only be one of a sort of a minor chorus here, and I would rather withdraw my support from the book. I want you to take out my stories. I want you to take out my quotations. I want you to take out the acknowledgement of me as a source, because I don't want to contribute to the prolongation of these myths." And I understood that, and I was very sorry to lose her in the book, but I did take her out.
You know, you didn't have to take her out legally, right? I mean, she'd given you the interview. She'd given you the information, and legally, I don't think she had the right to withdraw it. She was already on the record. Why did you let her take it back?
Because I thought she had a right to her own representation, actually. I know that that's true, that I don't think the legal and moral issues are the same at all. But what her complaint is that I didn't, in fact, buy her version of the family. Instead, I adopted a very complicated set of attitudes and perspectives on the central issue of, was Anne Sexton actually sexually abused by her father? The book, I think, argues that, or observes that you can't know for certain, but that the evidence is that she was not, at least as I read the evidence, but that Sexton's own memory of this was what in psychoanalysis is called a screen memory, a way, a story or a scene narrated to account for a set of feelings that are so profound and troubling that they need to have an explanation associated with them. And her explanation was that she must have had sexual desire for her father, which when he was drunk, he exploited or observed or intuited, and then that was observed by her great aunt, who subsequently went mad. Now, Sexton was making an explanation for why her aunt went crazy. She thought it was her fault, and she thought it had to do with her sexuality. And that very complicated story, which is so layered and so significant and so eternally returned to in Sexton's work, is crystallized in this one memory or fantasy which she recovered in trance. Now, that is an extremely important whatever it is, and needed to be accounted for. And what I wanted to do was have the families register this could not have happened, because they are convinced that it didn't, but played off against the deeper movement of the unconscious toward desire, and that Sexton's own work, I think, indicates that for her, that story had a truth to it, which might have been a mythic truth, but which had powerful, compelling force in her own emotions. So that was what I was trying for. It was not what the family wanted, and that's why they decided to withdraw. And I think have also sort of set up camp outside the covers of the book to say, look, this is an abuse of us. This story should not have been told because it couldn't have been true. And I just don't think there is any way to resolve that.
Anne Sexton's daughter, Linda, after she read one of your manuscripts, came to you and said that there was something very important that she hadn't told you about yet that she thought should be included in the book, and that was the fact that her mother had sexually abused her, had lied next to her in bed and masturbated, that she once woke up and found her mother was on top of her and kissing her. What was your reaction to Linda telling you this? And did Was it something that you questioned at all, or that you knew right away you'd have to include in the book?
Well, I was appalled, but immediately I thought, of course, because Linda, in fact, recovered this memory in the course of reading my account of the development of Anne Sexton's play, Mercy Street, which is about an incestuous relationship between a father and a daughter and also the great aunt and the daughter. There's a very complicated sexual relationship that was very much something Sexton was exploring. And what Linda discovered and didn't tell me about immediately was that she remembered these episodes herself, and she could see in from reading the chronological account that they were happening when Anne was working on Mercy Street, that this would be, her father would be away, her mother would be involved in this deep engagement with this fantasy or memory of her own past, and she would begin to act it out with Linda. It was, I believe, a pathological kind of episode. I believe that she was probably dissociated or very much entranced when it happened. Still, it was an appalling, horrible discovery for me.
One of the questions you set out to answer is, why did Anne Sexton's poetry appeal to people who normally didn't like poetry? How much of that appeal do you think was her self-destruction, and what does that have to say?
I wish I knew. I'm sorry to say that the self-destructive impulses are things that people are drawn to look at, and Sexton knew that, and she played on it. She gave an epigraph to one of her last books from Hemingway, "Look, you con man, make a living out of your death." It was a very cynical kind of epigraph. She knew that people loved the thrill of looking at somebody who had who'd been through self-destructive impulses, and she was able to act them out in her readings. Actually, she used to make this joke in the last year of her life that she was giving readings from her posthumous book. These very creepy sort of references to it was a given that she would kill herself. That was part of the Sexton persona that I did not like. I think, in fact, some people have made a connection with Madonna, and I think that's a good one. That is somebody who writes the material that she knows will be marketable and then stands there performing it and looking you in the eye and saying, are you getting off on this? So Sexton was pretty complicated about that.
I regret I've left you about 60 seconds or less to answer this really complicated question, but when you're dealing with this really kind of complicated subject matter of somebody who is mad, who committed suicide, who might have been the victim of incest, who probably committed incest against her own daughter, everybody starts wondering, what's the difference here between a voyeuristic approach to somebody's life and a literary approach to somebody's life and where they fit into the culture? I know you've given this a lot of thought. Could you help us reason through it?
Yes, I didn't write a victim story. I found a person who was capable of turning her bad experiences or experiences of evil into something else, a transformation, which was the power of art. And though she couldn't save herself by art, she actually could call upon her most deep and painful experiences and turn them into something that was a sharing of the human condition. And I think that that helped her, that she saw that that was a good thing to have been able to do. And that was the person I tried to write about.
Diane Middlebrook, recorded in 1991. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Linda Gray Sexton recalls what it was like to grow up with a mother who was a famous poet but was mentally ill. Linda Gray Sexton's memoir about her mother, poet Anne Sexton, has just been published in paperback. Also, we'll hear from performance poet Maggie Estep, and David Bianculli previews the miniseries Gulliver's Travels. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Anne Sexton committed suicide in 1974. For some of her fans, her death added to her tragic mystique. But that mystique was not helpful to the poet's daughter, Linda Gray Sexton. In 1994, she wrote a memoir about growing up with a mother who was an inspired poet, but mentally ill. That book, Searching for Mercy Street, has just come out in paperback. Linda writes that as a young woman, she fled from her mother's dramatics and pain and couldn't be around her. Now in her 40s, over 20 years after her mother's suicide, she says she's trying to get back to her mother. When I spoke with Linda Gray Sexton in 1994, I asked her to read a letter she got when she was 12 from her mother.
Dear Linda, I am in the middle of a flight to St. Louis to give a reading. I was reading a New Yorker story that made me think of my mother, and all alone in the seat, I whispered to her, "I know, Mother, I know." And I thought of you, someday flying somewhere all alone, and me dead perhaps, and you wishing to speak to me. And I want to speak back. Linda, maybe it won't be flying. Maybe it will be at your own kitchen table, drinking tea some afternoon when you are 40. Any time, I want to say back. First, I love you. Second, you never let me down. Third, I know I was there once. I, too, was 40, and with a dead mother whom I needed still. This is my message to the 40-year-old Linda. No matter what happens, you were always my bobolink, my special Linda Gray. Life is not easy. It is awfully lonely. I know that. Now you know it, too. Wherever you are, Linda, talking to me. But I've had a good life. I wrote unhappy, but I live to the hilt. You too, Linda, live to the hilt, to the top. I love you, 40-year-old Linda, and I love what you do, what you feel, what you are. Be your own woman. Belong to those you love. Talk to my poems or talk to your heart. I'm in both if you need me. I lied, Linda. I did love my mother, and she loved me. She never held me, but I miss her so that I have to deny I ever loved her, or she me. Silly Anne. So there. Hugs and kisses, Mom.
Linda, when did your mother write that letter?
She wrote that letter when I was a teenager. I believe I was 16. And I received it, but I did not allow myself to really take it in, and I put it at the back of a drawer in a strong box that held all my most precious things, and I rediscovered it a month after her suicide.
And what did it mean to you then when you rediscovered it?
Well, initially, I had no memory of ever having seen it, and this story is the way I begin Searching for Mercy Street, telling the story of reaching out and finding it and at first being frightened by it and not knowing whether or not it was in fact a suicide note, and rereading it, realizing it was a letter I had received as a teenager. At the time my mother died, I was 21, so some years had passed, and that I had kind of blocked it from my mind, because in this letter she is already talking about a time when she'll be dead. And it's directed to me at 40 years old, and I was 21 at the time, and it seemed very far away and very frighteningly far away.
When you rediscovered this letter, forgetting that you had read it years before, you thought maybe it was her suicide note. I take it she never really left a suicide note.
No, she did not. And we were all sort of surprised, because as everyone who's read her poetry knows, you know, she spoke so frankly of so many personal and private things, and yet here is a woman who put her whole life into words, and then she left her life without a word. It was hard not to, you know, to accept that there was no final note.
Do you think it was maybe because she expected to be rescued?
No. I think that she meant business. She had always before, when she had attempted suicide, she had done it with overdoses of various medications. And the day that she killed herself, she shut herself in the garage and left the car running.
You know, I think many of your mother's fans identified with her madness and even identified with her suicide, much as many of Sylvia Plath's readers did. But I think her madness, her suicide, had such a different meaning for you as her daughter than it did for people who were looking at her life from a great distance.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because really one of my main motivations in writing the book was I had this tremendous desire to strip away the myth that surrounds her, her life as a poet. People, I think, particularly her fans, tend to see, you know, they envision her as a depressed person hunched over a typewriter with a whiskey bottle at her elbow, creating great art. And the truth of the matter was, when she was very depressed, she rarely wrote at all. And so the depression took an enormous toll on her life as an artist, as a woman, and particularly on our life as a family. And one of the points I wanted to make, that really depression was her enemy, not her muse.
You think some people might have almost romanticized your mother's depression, but because of her illness, she sometimes had to send you away as a child because she was too sick to take care of you. And then when you got a little bit older, there were times when she wanted you to be her mother. You would play a game called Playing Nine. How would that go?
How would the game go?
Yeah.
The game itself was usually on a Sunday morning. We would have gone to church. Joy and I would have gone to church with a neighbor. And Mother would still be in bed. Daddy liked to call her a pad rat because she really liked to sleep a lot. And we had a family joke that she went to St. Mattress every Sunday. But in any case, so I would come home and she'd want to cuddle, and so I'd climb in, and I was 9 at this time. And what she would do is slide down in the bed so that her head was on my chest. And then she would pretend she was the child and I was the mother. And she would slip back in time to her own childhood with her Nana, who was her most adored adult, the one she felt she could really rely on. And they used to obviously cuddle a lot, and this she found very comforting. But unfortunately for me, recreating this experience was very anxiety-provoking, because sometimes she'd want to do this for an hour or an hour and a half, and I would become frightened. No child at 9 wants to be the mother. You know, a 9-year-old child needs to be the child. So these were very, very painful memories and really traumatic ones, I think.
There are many difficult decisions you've had to make over the years as the literary executor of your mother's estate. I imagine one of the most difficult was this. There were recordings of psychiatric sessions she had when she was in therapy in the 1960s, and you made the decision to release recordings and transcriptions of those sessions to your mother's biographer, Diane Middlebrook. Was that a difficult decision for you to make?
I don't think that it was difficult, although there was no decision that I took lightly. Mother herself had placed the tape recordings and the transcriptions of the tape recordings that were in her possession into the archive that she had indicated to me should go to a university library to be used for scholarly and biographical use, so that when further tape recordings became available via the doctor who had made the recordings, I simply followed suit with the rest of them. But I felt Mother herself made the decision.
Did she have a different standard of privacy than you did or than the rest of the family did?
Yes. Not than I did, but certainly than the rest of the family did, and in fact, perhaps more than most of the public does. There's a wonderful line from a poem called For John Who Begs Me Not to Inquire Further, who was one of her first mentors and who was quite shocked. He was a poet, John Holmes. He was quite shocked at the revelations she was making in her poetry. And in this poem, she explains herself by saying, "At first it was private, then it was more than myself." And I think that is sort of a nifty way to explain what went through her mind. You know, her motto really was that a writer's job is to dig deep into painful things and then to hold those things up before society so that society can see itself better. And that is the way in which we transcend individual experience and do our job as writers at illuminating things. I think that for the rest of the family, it's hard. It's very difficult, in fact, because most people who are involved with public figures don't, and certainly my father didn't bargain on, you know, essentially having my mother become a famous poet and then having a variety of the personal details of their life revealed.
What was it like for you to learn about how your mother felt about you from listening to tapes that she recorded with her psychiatrist?
It was pretty devastating because the material that's contained in those tapes, I had always prided myself on being my mother's favorite and her friend, because from the time that I was 9 on, she relied on me for many things. And yet, in the very beginning when I was a baby, she resented me because she felt she couldn't take care of me. And there was a lot of really painful revelatory material in some of this, some of these tape recordings and transcriptions, and even correspondence back and forth with the psychiatrist. And I had to go through all of that. Of course, it was part of my job as literary executor. It's part of what I'd said I would do.
Give us an example of something that you learned from the tapes that shocked you.
Well, when I was very little, my sister, I had gone back and forth many times to my grandmother's homes when my mother was too ill to take care of me, and my sister stayed at my grandmother's home for quite some time. And there were, you know, many times where she would just sit me in front of a television set while she was, mother would, sit me in front of a television set while she was typing away, or she talked a lot about hitting me and hating me because I was interrupting her, and she just, all she wanted to do was write because writing was the only thing that made her feel not crazy. That was really tough, you know, that kind of thing is, you want to know that your parents love you. And I know intellectually that it was her sickness, but when I was reading those things, I felt almost as if I were being hit again.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about your mother's illness and the problems that caused in your relationship. What were some of the special things about having such a gifted woman as your mother? Did she often show you her writing, and were you excited by her writing and by her sharing it with you?
Oh, it was the most magical part of the relationship. As I got to be a teenager, or even 11, 12, I would come home after school, and she would have been, of course, working during the day, and she would sit with me at the kitchen table, and we would drink tea and talk about her poems. And then as time went on and I began to write poetry too, we would share them back and forth. And what was so wonderful about her is that she never made me feel stupid when I didn't understand something. She took what I said very seriously, and that enabled me really to grow as a listener and as a reader. So that was a really enormous gift.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Gray Sexton's memoir about her mother, poet Anne Sexton, is called Searching for Mercy Street. It's just come out in paperback. Our interview was recorded in 1994. Coming up, performance poet Maggie Estep. This is Fresh Air. A new PBS series, The United States of Poetry, is focusing on the writers who are part of the rock and hip-hop world and read at clubs, performance spaces, and on MTV. One of the poets featured in the series is Maggie Estep. She's among the best known of these new performance poets. Sometimes she performs alone, sometimes with a rock band. She performed on the MTV Spoken Word Tour and on the big alternative rock and hip-hop event, the Lollapalooza Tour. Estep lives in New York, where she's often read at the New Yorican Poets Cafe. I spoke with her in 1994, after the release of her CD, No More Mr. Nice Girl. Here's the opening track.
Sucking his lips, going, hey, baby, yo, baby, hey, baby, yo. Maggie Estep, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks.
So, do the men yo-yo all the time in your neighborhood?
Well, it's a pretty frequent thing, yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Even where I, you know, when I wear, you know, a tent or something out, you know, it's still, it's like, hey, nice tent, babe.
So are you the kind of person who usually talks back on the street, or do you just save it for your music?
Well, I kind of save it because it's often dangerous to talk back. You know, you might get shot or something. But when I'm on my bike and I've, you know, and I'm going fast, I will talk back. You know, I'll say something, you know, ludicrous. Something right. that, you know, something sort of off the wall that really, you know, makes them, you know, pause and think, wow, what does that mean?
Like, what have you said?
Oh, you know, I just proposition them back, you know, with something completely absurd, like, I don't know, any number of things involving gardening or bathrooms or, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Now, Maggie, you used to sing with your band. How did you start doing spoken word?
Well, I've done spoken word, you know, for a while since I was, you know, I don't know, like 22 or something. And then I did that. And then the band was a separate entity. And then the spoken word thing, I started getting so much work doing that, that I left my band. But then I got a record deal and we needed music. So my band and I wrote stuff to go with the spoken word stuff and sort of created a new hybrid of rock and roll and poetry or spoken word or something.
So you were writing poetry all along?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, since I was, you know, 10 or something.
What are the poetry slams that you've been a part of?
Poetry slams are vicious competition. No, it's what, you know, you'll have four or five poets, and each poet gets up there and reads a poem and is judged. You know, they pick judges out of the audience at random, and they judge from 1 to 10. They score you from 1 to 10. And each round, you know, a poet is eliminated who gets a low score, and then it's down, you know, neck to neck with two poets, and then finally somebody wins. And it's you know, it's a kind of a... it gives poetry a new dimension and brings in a new kind of audience who are out to see blood, you know?
Did it mean a lot to you the first time you won a slam?
I was pretty shocked, you know, and then I kept winning them and I couldn't figure it out for the life of me. But, you know, I guess part of the reason I don't take it so seriously is that I always win, you know? If I always lost, I might feel differently.
You have a very assertive voice.
Uh-huh.
And I find that really interesting because I think we're in a period when a lot of women, particularly younger women, almost can't find their voice. That a lot of women have that rising inflection and a very tentative-sounding voice that seems trapped in the throat and seems to be a sign of insecurity.
Yeah, I do kind of notice that. I mean, there is this weird cultural trend in timid women and you know, and exemplified on like magazine covers where everyone, you know, like these big these models who are making all this money look completely helpless and childlike, and I find it incredibly annoying. I'm, you know, in your face.
Did you always have that kind of assertive voice?
I think so. I mean, I'm actually really shy and certainly have my own particular insecurities. But yeah, I mean, I always have been like, I was never victim girl, you know. I was always like, I'm gonna, you know, do what I want, thank you very much, get out of my way, you know.
Can I ask you to do one of your poems for us now, something without music?
Sure. I'll do a new one. It's called I'm an Emotional Idiot, So Get Away From Me. I'm an emotional idiot, so get away from me. I mean, come here. Wait, no, that's too close. Give me some space. It's a big country. There's plenty of room. Don't sit so close to me. Hey, where are you? I haven't seen you in days. What are you, having an affair? Who is she? Come on, aren't I enough for you? God, you're so cold. I never know what you're thinking. You're not very affectionate. I mean, you're clinging to me. Don't touch me. What am I, your cat? Don't rub me like that. Don't you have anything better to do than sit there fawning over me? Don't you have any interests, hobbies, sailing, fly fishing, archaeology? There's an archaeology expedition leaving tomorrow. Why don't you go? I'll loan you the money. money. My money is your money. My life is yours. My soul is yours. Without you, I'm nothing. Move in with me. We'll get a studio apartment together, save on rent. Well, wait, I mean, maybe a one-bedroom so we don't get in each other's hair or anything. Or, well, maybe a two-bedroom. I'll have my own bedroom. It's nothing personal. I just need to be alone sometimes. You do understand, don't you? Hey, where are you going? What? Was it something I said? I'm an emotional idiot, so get away from me. I mean, marry me.
a little approach avoidance there. So is this an autobiographical set of mixed messages?
Yes, definitely.
Maggie Estep is featured in the new series, The United States of Poetry, that will be featured over the next few weeks on many PBS stations. She performs tomorrow night in Los Angeles with a group of people featured in the series. Coming up, we have a review of the new mini-series, Gulliver's Travels. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday and Monday night, NBC presents a 4-hour miniseries adaptation of Gulliver's Travels, with Ted Danson of Cheers in the title role. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
You may have forgotten. For the last few years, I know TV has. But this is the sort of thing a TV miniseries does best. It takes an existing novel or an original work, gives it the time and care it deserves, and takes us somewhere else for a while. To ancient Rome in I, Claudius. To Africa and the Deep South in Roots. To feudal Japan in Shogun. And now we have TV taking us on Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels and doing a much better job than any previous film version. For one thing, its 4-hour length allows this particular Gulliver to travel to all the lands he did in the novel, not just the most famous 2 or 3. For another, the special effects from Jim Henson Productions are so good they don't even call attention to themselves. And the acting is just as wonderful. The supporting cast includes everyone from Peter O'Toole as the tiny Emperor of Lilliput, to Alfre Woodard as the towering Queen of Brobdignag. And while Swift's novel is 270 years old, its satire is amazingly sharp and topical. Here's a scene where Danson's Gulliver, a tiny man running breathlessly to keep up with Woodard's giant queen, answers her questions about justice and lawyers.
In your courts, how much time is spent in determining between right and wrong?
Oh, trials last weeks or months. At great cost to those involved.
Doesn't that mean the poor have no recourse to the law?
Well, the poor are too busy working to need justice.
Do your lawyers ever plead cases which manifestly they know to be wrong?
Of course. That's their job.
The chief miracle worker here is writer Simon Moore, who adapted Gulliver's Travels to TV by making several key changes, all of them brilliant. Instead of spacing Gulliver's adventures over 4 separate voyages, as Swift does in the novel, TV's Gulliver's Travels takes place on one long trip. In the book, Swift's wife and family are afterthoughts. In the TV version, his wife, played by Mary Steenburgen, is a key player. Her husband's sudden return pleases her, but also frightens her because he talks of things that quickly get him branded as a lunatic. Worse yet, he acts like a lunatic. Gulliver's adventures are so vivid in his mind that he keeps reliving them, slipping in and out of reality like Billy Pilgrim in Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5. This story structure allows NBC's Gulliver's Travels to get Gulliver to Lilliput almost immediately, and to propel the story forward with a real sense of urgency. The more Gulliver talks, the more crazy he sounds. And when a court is convened to rule on his sanity, his description of savage yahoos, totally uncivilized humans, doesn't exactly help his cause.
The bestial yahoos would fight for no reason at all. Whereas, as I explained to Mistress, in our society, we only fight for a very good reason indeed. Such as, well, because our enemies are much weaker than us, or we desire all their land.
Yet with all these liberties, NBC's Gulliver's Travels is very true to Swift's novel, dramatizing scenes that will surprise, and maybe even shock, people who think of Gulliver's Travels as a harmless children's book. There's a scene in Sunday's episode, set in the tiny kingdom of Lilliput, in which the giant Gulliver puts out a palace fire by urinating on the building. It's in the book. And if NBC's Gulliver's Travels gets the audience I think it will, more book adaptations are bound to follow as major network miniseries. And I'm not talking about Danielle Steele.
David Bianculli is the TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We close today with one of the most beloved recordings in the history of film musicals. It features the great Gene Kelly. He died today at the age of 83.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain. Dancing in the rain. I'm happy again. Singing and dancing in the rain.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from Random House, publisher of Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice by Harold J. Rothwax. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Republicans control the House and Senate and hope to win the White House. On the next Fresh Air, we examine the state of the party with journalist Ronald Brownstein, co-author of the new book Storming the Gates, Protest Politics, and the Republican Revival. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.